In addition to Merle Haggard, Cream, and Robert Johnson, another musician getting honored for Lifetime Achievement by the Grammy Awards is David Bowie. Bowie became an icon of glam rock after posing on the cover of his 1970 album, The Man Who Sold the World, wearing a gown and makeup. As rock critic Ken Tucker wrote in the Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll, in the face of the hippie era's sincerity, intimacy, and generosity, Bowie presented irony, distance, and self-absorption. His song Changes announced the arrival of a new counterculture.
Still don't know what I was waiting for, and my time was running wild in me in dead-end streets, and every time I thought I got it made, it seemed the taste was not so sweet. So I turned myself to face me, but I've never caught a glimpse how the others must see the faker. I'm much too fast to take that test. Change it.
Turn and face the strain.
Change it. Don't wanna be a richer man. Change it.
Turn and face the strain.
Change it. It's gonna have to be a different man.
Bowie also is known for the changes in personalities he created to go with his various music. His best-known character, Ziggy Stardust, mixed androgyny and science fiction. He wore elaborate eye makeup and lipstick and dyed his hair a bright red. Bowie seemed to reinvent himself with successive albums, including Scary Monsters, Let's Dance, and Outside. Terry spoke to David Bowie in the summer of 2002. She asked him about his reputation for creating alter egos to go with his music.
I think much has been made of this alter ego business. I mean, I actually stopped creating characters in 1975, for albums anyway. The only time that I've adopted characterization again since that point for my own albums has been an album called Outside that I did with Brian Eno a few years ago, which really had a myriad, maybe one too many characters, but had a lot of characters on that, and I played all the parts. But that was done as a sonic, theatrical piece of music. But the character thing really is sort of, for me personally, rather ancient history. But it's kind of, I guess over here specifically in America, the soundbitey thing really kind of stays around. And you're known by the, you're defined by the two or three things that the largest amount of people know about. And that kind of is who you are publicly. And mine is really Ziggy Stardust, characters, Let's Dance. That's me in the American, frankly, in the American eye. But in fact, in Europe, I'm more kind of this bloke what writes lots of stuff. And I kind of, I guess, a greater number of the 26 or so albums that I've made are known in Europe than they are in America.
How is your sense of yourself as a performer different now than it was when you were in your 20s and getting started and being, when you were in persona and doing the whole, you know, eye makeup and dyed hair and dresses when you wanted
that
to?
That was for 18 months, actually.
Right.
Which out of a career of nearly 40 years is not very long. I'll answer your question. I'm not actually a very keen performer. I like putting shows together. I like putting events together. In fact, everything I do is about the conceptualizing and realization of a piece of work, whether it's the recording or the performance side. And kind of when I put the thing together, I don't mind doing it for a few weeks, but then, quite frankly, I get incredibly bored. Because I don't see myself so much as a performer. I mean, I don't live for the stage. I don't live for an audience.
Can I stop you and say that I'm really surprised to hear that?
Most people are.
Yeah, because I always thought of you as somebody who really relished the theater aspect of performance and who very successfully made theater a part of music performance.
Frankly, if I could get away with not having to perform, I'd be very happy. It's not my favourite thing to do. As I say, I don't mind trying it out and making sure something seems to work well. But I really do rather want to move on because I think it's rather a waste of time endlessly singing the same songs every night for a year. And it's just not what I want to do. What I like doing is writing and recording and much more on the, on that creative level. It's fun interpreting songs and all that, but I wouldn't like it as a living.
Did you grow up thinking of yourself as a singer, or did you start singing because you wanted to sing, you know, because you wanted to perform?
No, what I wanted to do when I was 9 years old, I wanted to be the baritone sax player in the Little Richard Band. I probably also wanted to be black at that particular time as well. So I got my father to help me out with a saxophone, and we bought it over like a 2-year period. We had something in Britain then called the hire purchase system, or HP, and I bought it on HP, which is like you pay 2 and 6 pence a week.
Oh, buying it on time.
Yeah, over like 1,000 years. So in the end, it cost you maybe twice as much as if you could have afforded cash.
Right.
And I started playing around with local rock bands, you know, with the alto. And then, in a nutshell, somebody fell ill one night, the lead singer in one of the bands, and they knew I could sing, so they asked me if I would stand up. And I quite enjoyed it, actually, I must say, at 14. It was a real trip, you know, to have girls wave at you and smile and everything just because you opened your mouth and sang. But really, I guess, but no, I really wanted to do more than anything else up until I was around 16, 17, was write musicals.
Was write music?
Musicals.
Oh, musicals.
I really wanted to write musicals. That's what I wanted to do more than anything else. Because I like rock music, I kind of moved into that sphere, somehow thinking that somewhere along the line I'd be able to put the two together. And I suppose I very nearly did with the Ziggy character, but I had such short attention span and got disinterested so quickly after I'd created some kind of project that I wanted to move on. And I never really got the book together for the thing. So I had all the songs and the characters. But by the time we'd gotten it on the road and I'd been doing it for 18 months, oh, God, I couldn't wait to move on to something else.
You were briefly in a mime group before...
Yes, the Lindsay Kemp Mime Company.
Yeah, before becoming a solo musician.
Yeah.
Well, are there things that you learned or became aware of through that mime group that you said, yeah, that I really like that, I'm going to work with that in my own performances?
I think everything that I learned about stagecraft and carrying through, creating a through point for a theatrical device. I think Lindsay Kemp really introduced me to the work of Jean Genet, and through that I kind of kept re-educating myself about other prose writers and poets. Mm-hmm. He opened an awful lot of doors for me in terms of a new approach to what I could do. I could never have done what I did without being involved with Lindsay Kemp's company.
Well, getting back to Ziggy, you know, the story of Ziggy Stardust is a story of someone who becomes very famous. It's the story of rock and roll fame. Becomes very famous, and then fame becomes his downfall. He's kind of killed in a way by fame. What did that fable that you created mean to you at the time? Is that the way you saw rock and roll?
Well, I can only really look at it the way I look at it now, which is, I think, independently of myself, Ziggy Stardust has his own life. He's his own creation. And you know what? Good luck to him. But frankly, for me, I kind of closed the door on him in 1973.
Right.
And I'm very happy that he's having such success and that people still like him and all that. I heard he got married. Anyway, I personally have another life, you know, which doesn't belong to Ziggy Stardust. And I do tend to not really get that involved in what I've done in the past. I do kind of leave that up to other people. And that's much how I feel about Ziggy. I kind of prefer the audience and maybe writers or commentators or whatever, to make what they will of the Ziggy Stardust period and character, because it actually doesn't interest me much now.
Because rock and roll started as a youth music, everybody always wondered, well, will rock and roll continue to live? And what about the artists themselves? What about when they pass 30? What about when they pass 40? Or when they pass 50? You're in your mid-50s now. Is that an issue for you? Do you feel like you have... satisfactorily found a way to be a man in his mid-50s playing your music without feeling like what you're playing is, you know what I'm saying, that that you're playing music that speaks to who you are and where you are now.
Having not really written any generational songs, I think maybe two or three of the songs that I've ever written have any bearing on the age of the listener. My stuff tends to be far more concerned with the spiritual and with subjects like isolation and being miserable. So I think that sort of touches on really any age group. So in my terms, they're just songs. The vehicle for those songs is a music that did indeed start as a youth culture music. But it has aged well in itself, and it has become a vast and complex thing now, with so many subdivisions and styles and variations. No, it's just what I do. I mean, I wouldn't know how to write and play any other kind of music, frankly.
David Bowie, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
David Bowie, speaking to Terry Gross in 2002. Next week, he'll receive a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Grammys.